Hello and welcome back. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us. I'm Jay Hodges. I'm a proud friend of Sinn Féin. Today we're going to take a break from all the craziness in the world, the elections and the pandemic and Brexit and everything else. We're going to take a minute just to talk with each other and kind of get to know a little bit of an outside group that I've spoken with several friends are not aware of, but I'm excited to expose you to this group. We're going to talk to Ireland Futures and Relatives for Justice, Greatness Director Andrea Murphy. How are you doing this morning?
It's lovely. Thanks very much for having me, Jay. I'm delighted to be part of this.
And well, thank you so much for taking the time. Now, I want to talk about Relatives for Justice, and I definitely want to get into Ireland's future, but I want to kind of tell people about you because I don't think most people are going to know who you are. So tell us about yourself. Like you're originally from Dublin. You grew up there. Talk about your childhood and kind of growing up in Dublin.
So, well, as you say, I'm from Dublin. Grew up in the 1970s and 80s in Dublin, from a kind of working class background. And I was living in Talla. And if you knew Talla during the 1980s in Dublin, you'd know that it was so a huge social housing estate. And it was built kind of for all inner city dubs to move out to when there was housing stress. And that was really when I started to get political, I suppose. I certainly found that as a young woman growing up with all of the U2 fanship and all of the awareness around social and economic issues that were happening globally, say in South Africa or Salvador or all of those issues, there wasn't a focus on what was happening in Ireland amongst what kind of the youth kind of movements that were there at the time. And so I was just an ordinary person with my mum, who was a single mum, and with my two brothers. And I can remember vividly just things like we didn't have footpaths, we didn't have access to shops, we didn't have ordinary things. So you'd see women who were going across really mucky fields to be able to get a bus to go to a shop. And, you know, they'd be pushing a pram and having a shopping trolley and dragging a toddler with them. And I can remember vividly saying to myself, but this is something that men don't do. And it's something that policymakers in Leinster House certainly never think about and never talk about. And that was almost like this moment that I can look back on and say, yes, that's when I became political. I became political around women's rights, became political around what are the things that make a difference? And it became very, very obvious to me that the partition of my country had had this huge detrimental effect, creating two statelets that ignored women, treated them incredibly badly. And at that stage, we didn't even know how badly. We just knew that we were suffocating and we didn't have any power or access to power. And then the more that you started to look at that, then you started seeing the conflict that was happening in the north, which we were only allowed to view through a very narrow prism of outrage at IRA actions, rather than looking at the causes of conflict, looking at why the conflict was going on for so long and the issues that were in behind it. And once you started to actively search for those and actively search for people who were experiencing that, we'd so much more in common than with people, with women from Ballymurphy or from Derry than we did with women in Donnybrook or people who are occupying RTE. And so, you know, it became a natural progression for me and my politics to become involved in Sinn Féin at that stage. And then I moved to Belfast in 1994, about 6 months before the ceasefires. And so I've seen Belfast change, and some of it stay the same, really, since 1994.
What is it that took you to Belfast? Like you moved up there, but like, what is it that kind of moved you in that direction? Because you sound like you had a lot of stuff going on in Dublin and you were very active there. So what caused the change and move to Belfast?
Well, I met a fella from Belfast and so I moved up to Belfast. So, you know, it's not a very political story. But I mean, yeah, so I moved up to Leonardon, so I did, and then have been up ever since. And I fell in love with the type of politics that happens in Belfast. It's so rooted in ordinary people's experience and with an objective of creating a dynamic to create political change. And that change can be from making sure that people have access to decent social housing, to ensuring that there's language rights and that people can express their culture in an equal way, in a very day-to-day way, right through to the national question in terms of what is our constitutional future going to look like. And I think that really, I just fell in love with Belfast once I was part of it, and so very, very quickly got involved in community development, and then latterly with Relatives for Justice.
Now, a couple of things. I want to get to Relatives for Justice, but I feel like next time I'm in Belfast, I got to find this guy and buy him a beer, because the work that you've done with Relatives for Justice it's absolutely incredible. It's not only changing communities, but it actually has helped families and kind of bring a great movement forward. And so I got to find this guy that took you to Belfast and tell him, thank you so much. Can you explain to us what Relatives for Justice is?
Well, I'll tell you about my story with Relatives for Justice, and it might kind of explain it a bit. Okay. So while I was still living in Dublin in 1993, the IRA planted a bomb in near Manchester in a place called Warrington, and it killed two young children. And there was an immediate reaction in the south of outrage and people really wanting the IRA to stop their campaign. And it brought a lot of people onto the streets. At the same time as that happened, there had been a lot of state killings and killings where collusion was alleged, where the state were involved in killings that were being carried out by loyalism. And at that stage, loyalist killings had gone past for the first time in the conflict, killings by the IRA. So there was a real concern that if you only look at our conflict through the prism of IRA violence and condemnation, then you don't appreciate the multiple layers that have to be addressed in order to succeed in achieving peace. So families, Relatives for Justice, came to Dublin, and a number of us joined with them to say, us too. Yes, absolutely, you could talk about Tim Parry and Jonathan Ball, and absolutely, but what about Julie Livingston? And what about Carol Ann Kelly, children killed with plastic bullets? What about all of these people who died this week as well through loyalist violence? And unfortunately, some Dublin people spat on those relatives and they hit them. And I was arrested with a friend and charged with a breach of the peace for holding up the names of children on a piece of paper. So I moved to Belfast then and meet with Relatives for Justice and my now husband. And they asked me it was just after the ceasefires, to do a sort of exercise to say, well, what does Relatives for Justice look like in the context of peace or in the context of ceasefires? Because there were all these outstanding issues. So peace had been achieved as an objective, but then there wasn't justice or access to remedy for all of these families who were beginning a new process of grieving. Because once the ceasefires happened, it was like grief and pain were allowed to be expressed for the first time in many families, because conflict had gone. And so for them, they needed to have a place in the peace process. And the peace process has been blind to the experience of victims and survivors. So what we did in this planning session, and it was amazing. So I go into this little room, and there's Father Raymond Murray, who had been documenting abuses and violations from the days of internment. Claire Riley, exactly the same, this working class woman who was there holding women as their husbands were being dragged off or as their children had been killed. Emma Groves, blinded by a rubber bullet. Ailish McInnespy, whose brother Aidan had been killed at a checkpoint by a British Army soldier. Martin Finucane, Pat Finucane's brother. I was sitting in a room going, are you messing? Are you serious? This organization is absolutely astonishing. So I resigned from the job that I was working in and said, I will absolutely volunteer for this organization and get an organization that not only looks at those issues of outstanding remedy and justice, but also puts in place services that are needs-led for people who are grieving and who experience multiple trauma, so that they can have peer support, so they can have access to counselling, so they can have effective support services, because one cannot exist without the other. You can't, if you cannot get your shopping done without bursting into tears, then how are you meant to engage in a complex legal system on an equal basis? And you can't. So, you know, those things went hand in hand, led by those incredible people. And I was just so unworthy, but privileged to be part of that.
How old are you at this time, roughly?
Right. So let me see. So that was about 96. So I'd have been 25.
I love hearing this story, but I tell my nieces all the time, like, these incredible actions that are taking place all over the world all the time, we tend to think of them as being taken place by people who are seasoned and they have, you know, they're yeah. older and they have done whatever. But I keep finding more and more that they are people who are not that much older than they are. I mean, they're in their teens or their early 20s, and they're doing extraordinary things. Like, I absolutely love hearing that story. And it's so shocking to me to hear that you were that young and dealing with an issue that is A, this complex, but you know, this emotional makes it sound a little off, but it is, it's incredibly powerful. Like, it would be incredibly rewarding to be involved in that and be in that early. Now, I want to ask you about, I kind of want to hear more about just the process of Relatives for Justice and kind of just the people that are involved and whatnot. Can you share any experiences about the organization, you know, even as recent as today or whatnot?
So my husband is Mark Thompson, who's the director of it, whose brother was killed by the British Army in a shoot to kill operation. And he was very, very young as well when it was formed and as it's developed. And he's grown older with the organization as well. I think for me, the moments where, you know, and it's tough, right? This work is tough, and I wouldn't pretend to anyone that, you know, it's glamorous or whatever, because it gets some publicity. Sometimes people like assume that it's in some way sexy or whatever, because it's far from it.
Sure.
But it is rewarding in little small ways. So you could have a woman who will come to a painting class whose husband was killed in a black taxi, and she will spend 3 years painting nothing except black taxis. And then one Christmas she'll spend 5 weeks painting Tinkerbell for her granddaughter, and all of the class say nothing, but there's a cake for her when it's finished and it's framed and it's ready to go, because everyone knows that she has been on a new journey that is completely inexplicable to anybody else. And it is so personal. When we can make a change where a woman will turn around and say, I was able to put my bins out last night on my own for the first time in the dark for 30 years, that is when you know you make a change. And then that woman says, now, will you help me go and get the inquest papers so I can find out how my daddy died on a dark night when he was putting out the bins, right? Those are the transformative moments that you can't explain to anybody on a piece of paper in an evaluation form, but we know we make a change. For those families, they've seen processes where they've been vilified, where Relatives for Justice has been called everything from a Provo front to, you know, exalting terrorism and all of those things. We've had all of our management, all of the leaders in it completely vilified and had death threats. So Mark and Martin Finucane were going to the United Nations, and on the day before they were going to the United Nations to talk about shoot to kill and collusion with international observers, the two of them were stopped and given death threats by the RUC. They live with that as a normality that nobody else experiences, but they make a choice to say, that's okay. Our peace process and our process of transition from conflict needs to address those violations. Otherwise, we learn nothing. And otherwise, the new police service, the new criminal justice system is open to repeating those abuses of the past, because we have not appreciated what happened. So we went through the whole process of patent being reformed, for instance, and the families affected by RUC violations were incredible, making so many submissions to the patent process, telling their stories, incredibly painful stories, again and again and again. And so we did have reform. But the reform, no one said why. In any of the documents, it doesn't say because the RUC was up to its neck in collusion. It was engaged in shoot-to-kill violations. It was armed to the teeth with plastic bullet guns that had fired at the civilian population. None of that was said. Instead, we paid £0.5 billion to pay off the people who just didn't want to be part of a new police service. But without that missing story of violation and officially saying why, we are missing the piece that said why that change was necessary, and then we could always go back. So, you know, and that families always retain that goal, despite, you know, these grinding years of denial of their rights, is absolutely astonishing. And really, it humbles us every day of the week. So last week, it was incredible. We've had a big discussion about having a payment scheme for those who were injured during the conflict. And the people who are not allowed into that are people with psychological injury, who are bereaved, who were not at the scene where their loved one was killed. So you can live with the person who was at the scene when a person was killed, like a paramedic or a police officer or someone who carried out torture, could be given a pension. But the mother who was held back in for all the right reasons by her neighbors, by her family, from seeing her child on the street, is not allowed access to it despite surviving 40 years of PTSD, trying to raise the rest of her family and get every Christmas in. She's not allowed access to this. So last week in the newspaper, three women in the Irish News gave their testimony about what happened. One of them was a woman who grew up and never saw her mother who'd been killed by a plastic bullet. The other one, her mother was already dead when her father was killed and she had to raise her younger sister. She was only 13 when it happened. You know, these are the stories of people who never give up and are always willing to share their testimony. And so our job is to bear witness to that. Our job is to hear that, not go, my God, that was a sad story and I was really affected by it, but to make change as a result of it.
That's absolutely amazing. You can count me as a friend and a supporter of Relatives for Justice. I'll do anything you guys ever need me to do. I think that the mission is not only necessary, but I actually think it's beautiful. I think it's wonderful that you guys are engaging in what you're doing and really letting people meet on their own terms. It isn't something that's forced. It's, you know, it's years of painting a black taxi to get to painting Tinkerbell, but allowing somebody their own timetable and their own schedule, which, you know, that's an amazing journey and a great story. I hate to leave it, but I need to move over because it's not the only thing that you do, which that's more than what most of us do in our entire lives. And you've done it in a very short amount of time, but you're also involved in Ireland's future. Can you talk about that group, kind of what that group is and kind of how they tie in and what your role is there?
So I was lucky enough to be asked to be part of the management committee of Ireland's Future. And it's a civic group that came together around 2018 into 19, after the collapse of the executive and in the context of the threat of a no-deal Brexit.
Back up real quickly and just explain the collapse of the executive, so people understand.
So in 2017, the executive, the power sharing executive between at that stage Sinn Féin and the DUP, because the smaller parties decided to go into opposition in the previous election in 2016, it collapsed under the weight of a number of things. The kind of hair that the straw that broke the camel's back had been a scheme around heating, right, that had been poorly administered. And people refused to take responsibility for it. But the refusal to take responsibility for it and acknowledge it was symptomatic of some very serious issues that lay behind, where despite commitments in the Good Friday Agreement, the St Andrews Agreement, the Stormont House Agreement, to delivering social and economic rights to the population in an equal way, we saw an unequal distribution of those rights. So the Irish language community had been denied an Irish Language Act, and were constantly having to go back with begging bowls asking for those rights. We saw Irishness just being dismissed in this really abhorrent way, where, you know, there was a sense that Irish citizens, despite the promise in the Good Friday Agreement of complete equality, were having their Irishness undermined continually and their citizenship undermined. And then when Brexit came along, we saw that England would have a vote that would take the north of Ireland out of the European Union against its wishes, and the DUP completely dismissing that and saying, well, you know, London make a decision, that's it, you're going to have to live with it. So Irish citizens then went, you know what, we are not going to just accept that. We are going to have the Good Friday Agreement defended. We are going to have our rights as Irish citizens defended. And if you cannot do that in a power-sharing executive under those terms in the Good Friday Agreement, then we will resort to the other part of the Good Friday Agreement that says we can have a border poll which lead to national self-determination. And there are many of us who will argue that we will be a lot better retaining our rights. We will have social, economic and political rights under a new Ireland, under an agreed new form on this island, with always a special relationship with Britain, but also in the European Union. And so when those civic voices came together to voice that and to go to the Irish government primarily, because the Irish government were at that stage being very clever in saying to Europe, we want to defend the Good Friday Agreement, but we're not so clever in defending our rights as we lived our lives in the north of Ireland, and still don't. And so, you know, it began a new dynamic. The conversation about the constitutional future of Ireland never went away, but people had given the power sharing executive a chance and a real sense of, you know, that's the constitutional question kind of for a while. But as that broke down and as it was clear that it could not deliver, a new constitutional conversation began, and then Brexit comes in on top of it and just accelerates the lot.
Now, let me just ask this very bluntly as an American. What's the real potential for Ireland United? Really, is it actually doable? And I guess my follow-up to that would be, why now? Like, why does it make sense to do it now?
Okay, so is it doable at the minute? For the first time in my life, I can absolutely say yes. And that's a number of things that coalesce together. There's a change in demographics, right? There's just a larger number of nationalists on the island now. The South absolutely, in opinion poll after opinion poll, demonstrate that they will vote yes for United Ireland as well, despite many people in some of the political parties trying to obstruct that. There is a sense of the people who really, they kind of will identify as British or Irish, but not have a very, very strong view on the constitutional question, and we're happy with the status quo, who are not happy with being taken out of the European Union, who see the undermining of their civil and political rights in particular. And they are absolutely open to a conversation about what a new Ireland could look like and would they fit better in there compared to the absolute pantomime in Westminster at the minute. And then there's also something about the economics that we've seen happen. With Brexit, we've seen an accelerating of the conversation about how all island economics work and how it makes sense for us to work as an all island economic unit and on an all island educational unit as well has really come to the fore. And with COVID, we have seen, as an island, having two separate administrations going at a pandemic has made no sense, particularly for the person who lives in Donegal and works in Derry, or the person vice versa. And it has made no sense that our border, which is invisible in day-to-day life, becomes such an obstruction to sensible and progressive healthcare policies, economic policies, and everything else. So is there a chance? You bet. In the next 5 years? Absolutely. If we can just get past the "is this a legitimate conversation" bit and actually have the conversation, then it certainly is.
Now, I want to highlight one thing that you said, and I want to have you explain a little bit, because I was talking to a couple of friends of mine, and they said, of course, you know, you favor Irish, you know, unity on the island, but it's a Catholic issue. It's not, you know, it's just a Catholic issue. For an American audience, for the people who are there, can you, again, and you said it, but I really want to make sure that they hear this. It is so much more than just a Catholic issue, that it is so much more than that. And I'm, this is a personal privilege. I want to have this hit on.
It really suits the vested interests to say, this is the Protestants over here want to stay in Britain, and here's the Catholics over here want to unite in Ireland. That suits plenty of economic vested interests. Who it does not suit, and you can absolutely see this now, are people who want to have their rights, their human rights, whether they are in the LGBT community, whether they're in the BAME community, whether, you know, all those cross-secting communities have seen that their civil and political rights have been undermined to a terrible degree, even to the point that they could be seeing that the European Court of Human Rights won't have its application to the North anymore. Those people who also see their rights as European citizens and economic rights being undermined, as well as their access to markets and all of those business interests, are absolutely saying, well, you know what, if we can come to an accommodation that just looks like something we can all live with, we will absolutely consider this option. And there are more and more of those coming forward, writing, putting their heads above the parapet. And we just need to recognize that this is a legitimate conversation under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. People are fully entitled to say, I think our constitutional arrangements aren't working for our population right now, and we need to think about how we can make it work. And then we need to recognize that there are different traditions, different cultures. People will still, for instance, want a relationship with the Queen of England because it's really important to them, the same way, you know, and, you know, we can do this. We have come through so many really protracted and difficult processes over the past 30 years. Having a special relationship with a welcome friend is the least of it.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Thank you for doing that. That I think that will help some people understand that the severity of the situation, the importance of the situation. Now, I got a couple of quick questions to wrap up. The first one is, it's just, where can people go to find more information on either Ireland's Future or Relatives for Justice?
It's really easy. Irelandsfuture.com and relativesforjustice.com. Internet makes us all just part of it. And Relatives for Justice had been very fortunate to have a great relationship with a number of Americans in recent years, and those ties, and, you know, going to US Congress and being able to give evidence at congressional hearings means that Relatives for Justice has had some currency in its message and experience in those different arenas. And in terms of Ireland's Future, it's actually quite a new website, irelandsfuture.com, and we'd really, really welcome kind of commentary and suggestions around the online presence, because we recognize that diaspora are going to have a huge influence on the constitutional conversation, because the people who were forced out of our island because of the economic and social deprivations that we suffered since partition and the legacy of that, those families need to be part of this conversation too, about making sure that this new constitutional arrangement never sends away generations of its people again.
I will look forward to checking out both those websites and kind of seeing what's going on. Now, my final question is the one I ask everybody. You meet a stranger on the street and they say, I want to learn more. What do you recommend to them? A book that you recommend? Is it an album that you recommend? A podcast? Like, what is it that if you met a total stranger from North America and they said, hey, you know, I want to learn more, like, what is your recommendation?
So one of the things Relatives for Justice has done over the past 20 years has been a quilt. And it's that families will put what's in their heads and in their hearts and basically unspeakable things, things you can't express in a spoken way, onto pieces of quilting. And they have expressed loss and love and memory in those ways. So, for instance, there's a woman who lost her father and she used part of her wedding dress to make her square because her father wasn't there to bring her up the aisle, or someone who uses a photograph in the middle of it whose brother was killed, and they use the tie he's wearing in the photograph to border their square. So it's called the Remembering Quilt, and it has nearly 600 victims of the conflict, and their families have made squares in this, and it's vast, it's absolutely huge. But you can go on the Relatives for Justice site and you can go into each and every one of those squares, and it tells you who the person was, how they were killed, but most of all, what that imagery symbolizes for that family. And for me, that is a testimony to why we must ensure that conflict never happens again, that we are the last generation of Irish people who suffer conflict, and that we really determine that we will not see that repeated, but we will also ensure that those families are never forgotten and that they have their rights realized, and that our peace is a peace based on justice.
Wow. I will definitely be checking that out later today. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us, but I more want to thank you for everything that you have done and everything that you are doing. I think that it is that is an amazing story, and I can't wait to share it with people and encourage them to visit and get active and get involved. This is a very important piece of the overall puzzle, and I hope that people take the time to share this with their friends and their families, and to really let the exposure out and let people know what's being done there. Thank you so much for taking time to come in and talk to us.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jay. Thank you.
Oh, you're amazing. And I look forward to seeing you and Mark, fine, but seeing you and talking to you more and more in the coming months when we're able to travel again. So thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to everybody in the audience for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. And again, you know, become a friend of Sinn Féin's, share the video, tell the story, get out and get involved. We all know the guy that will find this completely fascinating and very interesting. And so I encourage you to reach out to that person and bring them into the fold and get them involved. Until next time, thank you so much. We'll see you soon. Salaam.